We have gathered here for a great opportunity. And even an ordinary opportunity should not be wasted. What to speak of this greatest opportunity to actually get our life together and make the highest progress. There's nothing wrong with wanting to achieve, but we must know what is the prime acquisition. If we can understand what is the topmost acquisition, then that propensity to want to achieve and gain will be perfected. So there's nothing wrong with wanting to achieve, to gain, to grasp, to have in your clutches. But you have to know what is that substance that you're looking for. How much are you willing to invest of your life for the highest purpose? Can you be truthful with yourself? Can you be honest? How much are you really hankering for the best? And how much are you willing to just settle for mediocre, the humdrum, ignorance, dullness? Each individual has to decide that for himself. How much are you prepared to sacrifice of the temporary in order to attain the eternal? How much flickering material happiness and distress are you willing to tolerate while keeping your eyes on what is the real prize? True happiness and satisfaction beyond the modes of material nature, beyond time, beyond bodily change, mental change. We constantly need to be reminded of what we are striving for. Otherwise, we'll easily grow weak and we'll get very mental, forgetting what is our purpose. By always being on target with your purpose, you'll be able to have sufficient drive and determination. Haziness in the mind is due to lack of a clear focus on what you're trying to achieve, what you're trying to acquire. We need to be able to sort ourselves out in terms of priority. We were discussing Wednesday at the loft amongst the crowd of newcomers there how, according to the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no greater mistake you can make in your life than to prioritize something higher than your own spiritual enlightenment. There's no greater mistake you can make in your life. I started out by asking the people, what do you think the greatest mistake is that you can make? And I got so many vague answers. The greatest mistake you can make is to be angry for a long time. Or the greatest mistake you can make is not to forgive. Or the greatest mistake you can make is to neglect opportunities whenever they are. So, no one could cut to the chase and understand that living this life thinking I'm this body and mind, neglecting my spiritual development, that is the greatest mistake. Living this life as if I'm an entity unto myself, devoid of any connection to the complete whole, the Om Purnam, that's the greatest mistake. So now the question is, how are we going to correct that greatest mistake in terms of making our priorities? You all are young men with some energy, some time ahead of you, you hope. And naturally, you want to have goals. You want to acquire some things. That means making priorities. What actually is worth sacrificing for? As Krishna told Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, if you don't sacrifice in terms of doing your both material and spiritual duty in this battle of Kurukshetra, you're going to sacrifice anyway. Material nature will exact its sacrifice from you. So, let us keep that in mind. What is the priority for our energies? If we don't have a solid program for our young masculine energies, you can be sure that Maya, the illusory energy, will have a program for you. That program is non-stop and all-consuming. In dealing with Krishna's illusory energy, you have to be proactive. You just can't take things sitting down. You have to be dynamic, you have to be outgoing, and you have to be into it. Otherwise, the illusory energy will work on you if you're inactive and have weak dynamics. It's like having weak digestion. You have trouble eating anything. But if the digestion is strong, then you can eat 10 pizzas and you'll be okay. Don't try it. So, we want to look at our internal dynamics. Are we lackadaisical, namby-pamby, wishy-washy? Or do we actually have something in us that's striving to achieve? Bhakti is not for lazy persons. You won't find anywhere in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna told Arjuna, you just lay down in the back of the chariot and sleep, I'll drive. No. Bhakti involves the reciprocation between Krishna and his bhakta, his devotee, and they're both relating dynamically. This is what attracts fortunate persons to the house of bhakti. They see the dynamics in action. They can see this is not just some kind of armchair philosophy or church pew religious belief. They see that this involves the fabric, the entire fabric of life. To see Krishna in everyone and everything, that is the goal. To connect all our activities with Krishna. This requires proper prioritization and powerful dynamics. We were discussing on Wednesday, what is life's greatest mistake? And the past few appearances that I've had at the Loft, we've been going over the theme of dormant resentment against some kind of supreme consciousness, supreme controller. So let's discuss a bit of that tonight. You all certainly aren't total newcomers to bhakti. Most of you have been practicing for some months. Still, we need to take a look at our heart and see how unconsciously we may have some residue of resentment. That I don't want any supreme consciousness, any supreme entity, any supreme absolute truth interfering with my life. There needs to be a part of me which no one can touch, no one can get past the fence. I need to have a guarded area in the core of my heart. And it's not fair that any kind of transcendental interferer can get in there. We'll allow Krishna to enter into the foyer, into the hallway, but we don't want him all. We don't want to let him all the way into the house. It's just not fair. Why can't there be a you that no one can interfere with. So we may have this unconscious resentment against Krishna. He's just too much, you know. Everywhere, all knowing. There's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Who wants that? You want some privacy for yourself. You want to put up some fences, some walls, and have confidence that no one can get there, supreme or otherwise. But when you start chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and reading Bhagavad Gita, you realize that you're exposed completely. And we may not be able to handle that fully. Unconsciously or consciously, we may want to make a deal with Krishna. I'll let you in the house just a little bit. There's a nice seat out in the foyer. But don't try to walk into any of the inner rooms. That's my business. Now, you shouldn't get on my case because most people won't even let you in the front gate, what to speak of in the front door. But I'm giving you a very nice place in the foyer. So, you should be happy, and I should be recognized as being very dharmic, very spiritual. But this idea of this notion of recognizing Krishna as said in Sanskrit, upadrashta and anumanta, the witness and the overseer, the permitter in everyone's heart. Oh, it's just too much. Now, if we are atheistic, demoniac, we'll even become very resentful and angry about this. It's like one famous Western intellectual, Freud, said, the thought that there is some kind of supreme entity that knows everything about the core of my heart, that thought nauseates me. That I don't have any place in the core of my being where I can put a wall up and just do my own thing without worrying about some ultimate controller. I can't stand the thought that there would be such a transcendent reality minding my business, my affairs. Let's try to really get a feeling for that. My business, my affairs. In other words, it's all right to have some kind of theistic belief in a supreme being. A theistic belief in God, however you want to define that. But to accept a reality in which that supreme being is does not respect the fences that you have erected. That just nauseates you. You don't like that. Don't they have that expression, good fences make good neighbors? Boundaries. Boundaries are for having civil relationships. But it seems that Krishna respects no boundaries. Look at Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. He had a lot of good reasons not to fight. Of course, the other side, the Kurus, they were aggressors. They had done not just one thing, but several things which the Vedas say require a self-defense. Nevertheless, what's wrong with Arjuna's not wanting to get into it and fight? That's his business, isn't it? If he doesn't want to do it, he doesn't want to do it. It's all how he feels at the moment. This is how we would analyze the situation today. It's all about our feeling at the moment. That is the paramount thing. Wednesday, when I was speaking, one guest brought this point up, that the greatest mistake you can make in life is not to live in the now. Sounds very good, huh? Trendy, huh? To live in the now. How many of you here also would espouse something like that? No, no one? Yes, of course. And people would nod their heads, yes, yes, very deep. To live in the now. His point was that if you get caught up too much in the past and too much in the present, what has been and what might be, you'll just neglect the glory of the now moment. So I told him, I said, guess what? The creatures that are most expert at living in the now are animals. They don't know anything else. They far excel human beings in living in the now. So, shouldn't we be aspiring for something higher than animal life? So let's get back to this notion of the transcendental interfere. We've got to get over our hang-ups about that. We have a fear. Krishna getting inside that core too much. All right, we've beat ourselves up in material existence. We've exhausted ourselves, driven ourselves crazy. All right, so now we turn to Krishna. But to allow that Krishna just marches right through the front door into the inner chamber and sits down, that may seem too much to us. That's why knowledge of Krishna is so important. The more you know about Krishna and what his activities are, then you'll slacken your guard and even take down your guard. You'll see there's nothing to fear. Sometimes people may ask you, well, all right, you say that we are lacking knowledge of the Supreme. What makes you think you are so possessive of knowledge of the Supreme? Even if we admit that we don't have it, what makes you so sure you have it? So how would you answer? In Chaitanya Charitamrita, a discussion about this point went on in a more sophisticated way, because the participants of the dialogue were extraordinarily sophisticated in philosophical understanding and prowess. One personality named Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita as the greatest philosopher logician of his time in all of India. And he was an impersonalist. He was a Mayavadi. Mayavadi means someone who thinks that anything to do with the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of Krishna is Maya, the highest Maya. They're called Mayavadis. The truth is Maya. That's what Mayavadi means. They think that the Supreme Absolute Truth is Maya. So, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's brother-in-law, Gopinathacharya, was a devotee, a great associate of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so, Gopinathacharya was pointing out to his brother-in-law, Sarvabhauma, you don't actually understand anything about the Supreme Absolute Truth. You don't recognize Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who's right here before you. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya replied, well, certainly we respect and we can see that he's a great devotee, but how can you say he's a supreme absolute truth? So then Gopinath Acharya began to quote from Shastra, because it is by the uncommon activities of a personality, inconceivable activities, as well as by the descriptions in the Vedic literature, that we recognize an incarnation of Godhead. Any incarnation that is to be recognized by human beings is described in Srimad Bhagavatam. In other words, it's not that those are the only incarnations. You might have remembered reading in the first canto that Krishna incarnates in every species of life, not just human beings. But you're only responsible for recognizing those incarnations that are listed in Srimad Bhagavatam. Otherwise, as stated in the first canto, just like you can't count the waves in the ocean, similarly you can't count all the avatars, the incarnations of Godhead. Now, does that mean that you should just go around speculating, here's an avatar, there's an avatar, everywhere's an avatar? No. You're only responsible for recognizing those listed in Shastra. That protects you. So you have to look for two things. You have to look for the inconceivable activities, not just some magic tricks, but inconceivable activities, as well as mention in the Shastra. So Gopinath Acharya explained that to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Lord Chaitanya is described in the Vedic texts. One name of Krishna is Triyuga, the Lord who appears in three yugas. Except for Kali Yuga, Krishna appears as a Leela avatar in the other yugas. A Leela avatar means the Lord takes on various forms for his own pleasure. And his activities are full of bliss and completely independent. Usually, there are two purposes when Krishna and his incarnations appear in this world. Krishna in the form of his incarnations, when they appear in this world, they have two purposes. Those are described in Bhagavad Gita. Prithanaya sadhunam vinashaya tadushkritam. In order to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, Krishna says he comes. Now actually, he doesn't need to come to deliver the pious, because by their activities they're already delivered. And he doesn't need to come to annihilate the miscreants, because just one earthquake, one flood, and they're finished. But really, Krishna and his incarnations come for their own pleasure, to give enlivenment to the devotees by the activities of Godhead. The devotees never tire of talking about those activities. But in Kali Yuga, there's something different going on. There's no Leela avatar in Kali Yuga. And Krishna doesn't come for those two purposes, to annihilate the miscreants and deliver the devotees. No, Krishna comes covered. Another name for Lord Chaitanya is Chana avatar. hidden avatar. He's Krishna coming as his own devotee to taste what it's like to be a devotee. So Lord Chaitanya is not coming in order to annihilate the miscreants and deliver the pious. Primarily, he's coming in order to taste what it's like to be a devotee of Krishna. Krishna himself wants to taste what is that like? It's like here you are at the Garuda Ashram. Before you were living here, you might have been thinking, I wonder what it's like to be there. I wonder what it's like to live with these persons. Let me find out. Let me taste. I'll spend a weekend there. So similarly, Krishna himself wonders, I wonder what it's like to be a devotee. I wonder what it's like to be in love with me and to taste the love of Krishna. I'll come as my own devotee and experience what it's like to be attached to me. So that is Lord Chaitanya's mission. And Gopinathacharya pointed out to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you should be able to recognize that this is no ordinary person. So, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya being no ordinary human being in terms of vast knowledge and philosophical understanding and logical prowess, and all right, it may be so, if we can accept hypothetically that I don't know what is the Supreme Absolute Truth, but what's the evidence that you know? So Gopinathacharya gave a very interesting answer. He said, the proof that someone has knowledge of the Supreme Absolute Truth is that they understand the energetic source and the energies together. Now think about that. When you examine the various spiritual systems giving some idea of the Supreme Absolute Truth, where do you get that complete picture of the energetic source and energies together? This is what is so special about the knowledge in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. You get to understand the Supreme Absolute Truth and his potencies side by side. You can't separate one from the other. In other words, you're understanding the milk and the cow together. How can you understand the cow without the milk? How can you understand milk without a cow? So, in looking at various attempts to give knowledge, sincere attempts to give knowledge of ultimate reality, we don't find both those two inseparable realities together. The energies of the Supreme and the Supreme energetic. We look at your life, and in your own tiny way, you're an energizer with energies. And through your energies, through your potencies, you get things done. Whether it's playing music, or doing physical activity, or university activity, you have your potencies by which you get things done. How? In other words, Gopinathacharya's point to his brother-in-law is, how can you say that you have definitive knowledge of the Supreme if you don't understand the Supreme alongside his energies? They're always together. So I hope you can start to think about this. When you're talking about the sun, how do you avoid talking about heat and light? The intelligent person is able to look at the heat and light and in that way understand the sun. So similarly, Gopinathacharya's point was, a true spiritualist would be able to properly perceive the energies of the Supreme and in that way understand the Supreme. But just think, most people are bewildered. They just see, oh, here's heat, there's light, and there's the sun. It's just all scattered, you know? They can't put the whole package together. Just like some of you are studying holistic healing. The idea is you're supposed to see the whole package and how the whole package works together. Whereas Western medicine supposedly just focuses on one aspect of the whole system. And so in that way, inconsistencies and imbalances always result because you're not dealing with the whole package. You're just focusing on one isolated area, but that area actually isn't isolated. So one thing we can understand about the Western attempt at civilization is that it's very reductionist. Reduce everything to fragmental parts. Don't worry about the whole. So many people are thereby attracted to Eastern thought because they see that there's some attempt to be holistic. But our point is, following in the footsteps of Gopinath Acharya, how are you going to be holistic and reductionist at the same time? They all fit together. The parts all fit into the complete whole. And what's more, the complete whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That means if you put all the parts together, all Krishna's parts together, put all his energies together, that won't make up the complete whole, because Krishna is more than the sum total of his parts. Krishna has his own original independent personality. Krishna does not deplete himself. He doesn't deplete himself when he expands into parts and parcels. When he expands his energies, he doesn't become less. This is spiritual mathematics. 1 minus 1 equals 1. 1 plus 1 equals 1. Although Krishna emanates countless, infinite living entities, and he has so many energies emanating from him, he still remains intact. He doesn't become depleted like letting air out of a balloon. So I've been meditating on this statement by Gopinath Acharya for many years, actually, since I first saw it in 1975. So it's almost 40 years. And gradually I've started to get realization of it. What he meant when he told his impersonalist brother-in-law, the proof that someone actually has not genuine knowledge of the Supreme is that they can see the whole package, the energies and the energetic source together. Just like when you look at the sun, you realize this, the sun, planet, and its heat, light. If you don't understand the heat and light are connected to the sun, that means you don't understand the sun. And if you don't understand that the sun has heat and light, you don't understand the sun. And of course, you don't understand the heat and light properly also. So just imagine you're wandering around. It would be like a little child. Oh, there's some heat. I feel some heat. Oh, I see some light. And oh, there's the sun in the sky. Can't make the connection. Little kids like that. So that's the problem that so many sincere attempts at understanding the science of God have. They can't put the whole package together and see how Krishna eternally exists with his energies. And he's not diminished by the expansion and outflow of his energies. The Shastra says, Eko Bahusham, the one has become many for his own pleasure. You see, people in this world, they like to expand for their own pleasure. No one wants to be alone. People want a partner. And then, once they get a partner, they may think, at least the woman thinks about children. And the more, the merrier. You want to... I was speaking to one devotee today. The father with a 2-year-old son. And so He was explaining, yeah, it kind of feels like you've done something, you know. You've expanded. Well, yeah, you have done something. But, you know, you feel like you've, you know, made your mark in the world, you know. Chip off the old block, you know. You've made an impression, a lasting impression. You're going to take some satisfaction that the world is different because of your production. So, the Acharyas give that as an example that we have that tendency to want to expand because we're part of Krishna. And Krishna expands unlimitedly. Now, what was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the greatest scholar of Indian of his day? That's like in the 15th century. 16th century, early part of the 16th century, late part of the 15th century. Around the same, a little bit after the same time that Columbus ran into what he called America. So, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, being a super impersonalist, super Mayavadi, had the idea that, okay, through very powerful logical analysis, we can understand that anything created must have a creator. So, in other words, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya wasn't like ignorant scientists of today who would say that things have just randomly generated out of nothingness. And that the laws of nature have brought everything into being. Well, what brought the laws of nature into being? So if you say Krishna brought everything into being, you say, oh, how unscientific. But if you say the laws of nature brought everything into being, very intellectual. So we've discussed this before. How can you say that laws of nature, which are just descriptions of regular events in nature, which you assume will go on happening, just like someone here has an alarm clock and it's set for 6 o'clock every morning. You observe. At 6 o'clock every morning there's a sound and then Philip arises. So, every morning this happens. Then you can make a law of nature that when you hear such and such a sound at 6 o'clock, you know Philip will be up. Now someone might say, but there could be a time when that doesn't happen. So actually, if you're honest about so-called scientific laws of nature, you have to say that as far as we know and as far as we've seen and as far as we can speculate, these are laws of nature, because you haven't seen the whole universe. But it takes humility to say like that. But instead, though, they say, these are laws of nature. Laws of nature are just descriptions. When the clock reaches 6 a.m., it makes a sound, and then up pops a human being. Saying, honey ball! He races to the shower and then puts on his clothes and reaches his hand into his bead bag. So that so-called law of nature is a description of events that have regular patterns. But that law of nature doesn't have any power with it. It doesn't contain any power, and it doesn't have any ability to cause things to happen. So what Gopinath Acharya was explaining to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is that The supreme absolute truth has potency for causing things to happen, has power. The supreme absolute truth is not just a description. No, you're talking about causal potency to set things into motion. And that, in order to set things into motion, requires power. Therefore, when you understand Krishna as being the prime initial mover with the potency to get done what he wants done, then you're starting to see the whole picture of the Supreme Absolute Truth. The possessor and his energies. So where else are you going to get that kind of information? That's why, especially here in New Zealand, I shy away from using the word God, because people have such an impotent conception of that word. It practically is such a devalued word that it's often best to avoid it. I was speaking Tuesday at University of Melbourne. Very nice program. Very attentive audience. And so during the question period, one student, he wanted to be a little challenging in a modest way. So, I take it that you believe in God. Is your God a vengeful God? Just like the Christians have this idea of a vengeful God. So I said, well, if there are any Christians in this audience, they might be taken aback by your presentation of them, because they, there's the Old Testament God who one may say is vengeful, but then there's also the New Testament with the loving God. I said, in either case, no matter what religious system you're trying to follow, whether you say the Supreme is vengeful or the Supreme is loving, what you're actually saying is that the Supreme Absolute Truth has qualities, and only a person has qualities. So then we must get the deepest knowledge of that Supreme Conscious Person who has qualities. Don't just stop and say, oh, he's a vengeful God. Is that what you're saying? No, no, he's a loving God. What about the qualities? Conscious persons have qualities. So what? Where's our knowledge? Where's our knowledge of the qualities of the Supreme? The Vedic literature describes how the Supreme Absolute Truth has qualities, potencies, energies. You think, feel, and will, you get a little bit done. Generally, getting yourself into more of a mess than you're already in. But you have some potencies. Musical potencies, healing potencies, cooking potencies, singing potencies. So many different kinds of energies. So the Vedas say about the Supreme Absolute Truth, Parasya Shaktir Vividaiva Shruyate. The Supreme Absolute Truth has unlimited potencies, but we basically summarize them as the material energy, the spiritual energy, and the living entity is the marginal energy. That's the basic summarization. But please remember that the Supreme Absolute Truth has unlimited varieties of energies. So, try to understand this. Impersonalism strips the Supreme Absolute Truth of potencies. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had that notion. He had the notion that All right, there's a creator. Call the creator what you may, but the creator has a material body, and within that material body is the impersonal Brahman. So the highest reality, according to impersonalism, is the impersonal Brahman. Why do they say like that? Because they can't conceive that there can be a person who has unlimited potency. Any person they've seen in this world is limited. So they think, how could the ultimate be personal? Personhood means limitation. This is speculation. So therefore, because they can't get their heads around there being an unlimited person due to their speculation, then they posit, they imagine that there's an ultimate impersonal reality, which has no distinction between energizer and energy. They can't allow for any distinction between energetic source and energy, because what does that do? Who knows? It means everything's not one. So when you want to reduce everything to oneness, you've got to kick out any kind of distinction whatsoever between lover and beloved, between energy and energetic source. So they speculate that there's this ultimate all-pervading energy. Now in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, indeed, there is an all-pervading energy, but it's not ultimate. Krishna says it's dependent on his personality. Brahmanohi pratishtaham. Krishna says, at the end of the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I'm the basis of the impersonal Brahman. The impersonal all-pervading reality is subordinate to me. It's Krishna's effulgence. Can there be a person so great to have the all-pervading spiritual energy as his effulgence? We'd like to have a bit of effulgence. Look in the mirror and see a halo around our head or something. But Krishna's effulgence, Krishna's so-called halo, is Brahman, which is subordinate to him. So we do recognize an all-pervading spiritual reality, but we know it's subordinate to Krishna. It's based upon Krishna. So impersonalists, they have this concept of all-pervading impersonal energy. Just that's it. It's just energy just out there, you know? It's just... They can't accept that there are spiritual forms, spiritual personalities, spiritual individualities. Why? Because they've looked around in the material world and they've seen that all persons are limited, all form is limited. Therefore, perfection must be formlessness, personalitylessness. Part of the problem, a big part of the problem, is envy. You can't accept that there's such a personality as Krishna. Although Krishna does everything you'd ever want to do. But the problem is it's Krishna who's doing it, not you. Some persons who try to read the Krishna book, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they have a tough time because just to acknowledge that there could be such a personality is so difficult for them. Maybe some of you had that problem in the beginning before you became more purified. Anyone? Yeah, like, wait a minute now, is this for real? But look yourself in the mirror and ask, you know, are you for real? Look at all your attempts that have failed. Look at all your hollow goals and frustrated endeavors. So naturally, we conditioned souls envy Krishna. Look at all that Krishna does. He plays music all the time. He doesn't have to worry about selling CDs. He dances with the most beautiful girls in the middle of the forest in the middle of the night. And there's no worry about birth control. He has the most loving mother and father. He has the best friends, the best mates. They do the best matey things. So we can feel a bit uncomfortable about all that. And that person says that the all-pervading Brahman is based on him. It's his effulgence. Even Lord Brahma, Adi Deva, original Deva, the original demigod, he had sometimes had problems trying to understand Krishna. This little cowherd boy in Vrindavan, is that really my worshipable Lord? So even he could make a mistake in understanding Krishna. What to speak of puny human beings who try to speculate about Krishna? So this was Gopinath Acharya's point to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. His point was that you cannot understand the Supreme Absolute Truth by speculation. And actually, you can't understand the Supreme Absolute Truth just by reading the Vedic literature. Lord Brahma himself has stated, Vedeshu Duryabham Aduryabham Atmapokta. Krishna is very difficult to attain just by reading the Vedas. But he's easily attained by his devotees. So it's not by studying the Vedas that you can actually understand Krishna. You need the mercy of Krishna and Krishna's devotee, which is the catalyst for all the devotional processes to gel. So we're not just studying Vedic literature, we're trying to get the mercy of Krishna and Krishna's devotee, and that's what brings everything to life. So Gopinath Acharya explained to Sarvabhauma that unless you get just a dust particle of mercy, you won't be able to understand the slightest thing about the Supreme Absolute Truth. No matter how great your logical abilities is, no matter how smart you are, even you can read the Vedas backwards and forwards, but you must have the mercy of the devotee and Krishna. So this is what we're striving for. We're striving to please someone. It's subjective. So that was Gopinath Acharya's conclusion to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Here we have Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu right in front of you. You don't understand that. Why? Because you don't have any mercy in your life. And remember, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya asked him, well, okay, accepting that what you say is true, what is the evidence that you have mercy? and go be another chair, I said. One who can see the whole package, the energetic source and the energies all together. Like looking at the sun and seeing the heat and light. When you see the whole package, that shows you have some mercy. So again, in thinking of so many attempts to for spiritual knowledge, we see that no one gets the whole package. The whole package means the Supreme Absolute Truth and the potencies of the Supreme Absolute Truth and how those potencies work. So Krishna introduces you in Bhagavad Gita to his potencies. I've got a superior potency. I've got an inferior potency. Bhagavad Gita is the introduction. And then in Srimad Bhagavatam, you see those potencies in depth. How they are, how they interact, and how Krishna wields them. So Gopinath Acharya's point is, this shows that you have the mercy of the Supreme, in that you understand this whole package and you can present it. So I hope that at least some of you can grasp the significance of this presentation by Gopinath Acharya.